What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. We've been on a little bit of a hiatus, but we are back. I have some good guests coming up in future weeks, but I figured I would just ease myself back in with a Q&A episode. It's been a doozy. Jenna and I, doozy. I don't think I've ever said the word doozy in real life before, but it certainly has been. This is an appropriate time to use the word. Jenna and I moved from Jenna Emerson and I and Callie and Gunner moved from North Carolina up to New Jersey to be closer to family. And I will tell you now, I will die in this house. I am not moving again. This is it. I don't care if there's asbestos in the walls or I'm not moving again. if we had to move, I'm burning the place down and committing, you know, some sort of insurance fraud. Like, I ain't doing it again. That was an experience. We got absolutely smoked by the movers. They just took us for a ride, financially. I shared a little bit about on social media, just for a warning for other people who move. You know, when you call movers, they tend to get an inventory of your whole house. So you spend quite a bit of time FaceTime, you know, on the phone, listing out every single thing in your home so that they can get a clear picture, and then they give you a quote. And the first time around, it's like months before we moved, we got that quote and we were like, yeah, that sounds reasonable, sounds good, we'll go with you guys. And then 3 days before the move, when everything's been arranged and there's no way to change plans. I mean, it's the end of August. It is the busiest moving week of the year so that kids can, parents can move and get their kids into school. And this is when people sell and buy houses and move so that, you know, things can be settled for the school year. 3 days before the move, we get a phone call just to go through the inventory one more time. You know, I was like, okay, like that, cool, like no problem. Like, we're a little closer, let's go through it again, let's just double check. And we did the same thing, basically, just went through everything again. And except this time, they were like, oh, you listed like 100 extra items. You said that you have so much more stuff this time around. Wow. And our new quote is, you know, we don't need to talk hard numbers, but it was like 1.5 times the original quote. And when we're talking about thousands of dollars, this was more thousands of dollars. And you know, at this point, there's just not much else to do. You know, you can report them to the Better Business Bureau. We did that. But if you go on the Better Business Bureau, every single moving company has horror stories exactly like this one. It was just a frustrating experience. So just warning to anybody out there moving, you know, maybe just take, I don't even know what to take from that, but just kind of bake into your expectations that this is going to be a challenging experience. But all things considered, they moved everything in and things were not really dinged up. They did a good job, you know, putting XYZ together and all that. And they showed up on time, kind of, I guess. It's been stressful. They say moving is one of the most stressful things you can do. And I absolutely agree with that. Last couple times we had like one dog and no babies. And now we have one baby and two dogs. And so, yeah, we're settling in. House is great. We're happy. We're outside of Philadelphia in New Jersey, on the Jersey side, outside of Philadelphia. So if you're in the area, hit me up. Let's be friends. But otherwise, let's get into this Q&A episode. We'll do as many of these questions as we can in roughly a half hour. And then we have some good guest and solo episodes coming up the next few weeks. I have not read any of these questions, by the way. We're going to go through them. If I think that there's a question that's either inappropriate or just not going to be helpful, let's say, I might skip it. But other than that, this is going to be just some raw, unadulterated Q&A here. So first question, have you increased your creatine dose yet? I'm curious what you think would have prompted me to do that. The literature has been clear that the upper end of 0.1 gram per kilogram of body weight, which for me is like, you know, between 8 and 10 grams per day, is practical. That 3 to 5 grams is also completely practical. And that my take is the delta between not taking creatine and taking creatine is still incredibly low. What I mean is creatine doesn't do that much. So the delta between taking, you know, a modest dose of creatine, let's say 3 to 5 grams, and a maximal dose of creatine at the upper end of like 0.1 gram per kilogram body weight, just not super meaningful. So I'm not stressing out about it. I take between 5 and 10 grams of creatine per day, but not because there's super ironclad literature that points to a benefit at higher doses. If we're talking about cognitive benefits, so far cognitive benefits have only been seen in a very short span of time in much older people, not yet in long-term data and not with like young, healthy people. And so I'm not saying that there's no chance that there is cognitive benefits. I would bet that there's some sort of net positive in terms of cognitive effects, but I've increased my dose maybe over the year from like 5 to between 5 and 10 as a larger person, just as a person who's in that like 8 to 100 kilograms. You know, I'm not 100 kilograms, but yeah. So I haven't increased my dose from there, but that's where I'm currently at. Next question. Can a boot camp, which is mostly free weight type of class, sub in for cardio? No. But we'll get to that in a second. I know it's not good for hypertrophy, but I do like them much more than machines and wondering if it's helping or hurting my goals. I have a decent amount of muscle and definitely not getting much, if any, cardio except walking. So everything's a spectrum. If you're saying, hey, it's a boot camp, it's mostly free weights, is that equally good as doing what I would consider traditional monostructural high cycle rate cardiovascular activities? And you don't even need to, I don't even need to tell you what that means. You already know. It's all the things that you already classify as cardio. It's running, it's biking, it's hiking, it's swimming, it's Stairmaster, it's elliptical. All the things that you, it's playing sports. It's already all the things that you would classify as cardio. Is this the same thing? Is a boot camp class the same thing? No. Is it on a spectrum of like, let's say hypertrophy to cardio? Is a boot camp class or like strength and hypertrophy training to cardiovascular exercise, is this closer to cardio than your normal weightlifting sessions? Yes, it is. Are you getting some cardiovascular benefit? Absolutely. But let's assume this is some sort of Metcon, right? Like a metabolic conditioning class. Like you're doing fast-paced circuit training, always moving, kind of F45 Orange Theory type of stuff. It's not going to be as good for cardio. You're just going to keep it really simple. How can I put this super simply? It's less good for cardio because you're going to get more fatigued on a local muscular level, and that fatigue is just going to limit your ability to do as much work as you'd be able to. When we're talking about like running or biking, et cetera, you won't be taxing the high threshold motor units as much, and so you won't be taking on as much local muscle fatigue. Of course, there will be some local muscle fatigue for sure, but not in those big, powerful, high threshold motor units if you're doing something like long distance exercise or longer duration exercise. And so Metcons tend to suffer from that, where you're doing individual exercises that get you really tired, but it's not necessarily the same thing as higher cycle rate, monostructural cardio, where you're increasing cardiac output for, let's say, slightly different reasons. And so long story short, boot camp classes, you know, F45, Orange Theory, Barry's Bootcamp, whatever. I love those things. I think that they have gotten a bad rap. You should do those things if you love them. And they will give you a bit of everything, right? They'll give you a tiny, let's say you're completely untrained, right? You have never worked out before. Doing something like CrossFit or something like Barry's Bootcamp or Orange Theory, something that's a bit more of a kitchen sink, because you have nothing, right? You have no adaptations, you have no fitness. You will get better at everything. You'll get stronger, you'll build muscle, you'll improve your cardiovascular fitness, all of it. I think there's probably some sort of subtitle here of don't go from 0 to 5 Orange Theory classes, you'll probably get injured. But just in general, because you're not well-trained, you'll get a bit of everything. But if you are looking to use these classes as a form of cardio for you to get much better at cardio, I don't think you will, but I think that they count more for cardio than your weight training classes. So if someone's like, hey, I walk, I lift, and I do these classes, how am I doing in terms of cardiovascular fitness? The answer is probably pretty darn good. So I'm not saying that you, if you're not doing, you know, traditional monostructural high cycle rate cardio, that you can't have a healthy heart. But if you were agnostic, right, which it doesn't sound like you're agnostic, it sounds like you like these classes, right? And if you were agnostic, looking for the best bang for your buck in terms of cardiovascular fitness and cardiovascular health, I would pick something, you know, more traditional in terms of cardio exercise. Next question, how much fiber should you eat per day? As much as your GI system can handle, period. You know, we have several studies where just the more fiber you eat, the less you die, period. And so, you know, I think it's the Zhao or Zhang. I'm going to mix up those two names. That just showed basically the headline of, you know, with every 10 gram fiber increase, you know, we see all cause mortality go down by 10%, which is insane, by the way. It's amazing. So the general recommendation for fiber intake is between 10 and 15 grams per 1,000 calories. So if you eat a 2,000 calorie diet, that's between 20 and 30 grams of fiber, which has led people to say, you know what, men somewhere around 35 grams and women somewhere around 25 grams. And that's just an extrapolation on average size. That's not really a gender or sex thing. I think the true answer is as much fiber as your GI system can handle. And what I would say is if you are increasing your fiber, do it gradually. You know, if you're like, hey, I've never, ever, ever eaten vegetables before, and then you just eat a ton of vegetables, you know, you might not feel very good. You might say, oh, my GI system can't handle that. The truth is your GI system is very trainable, very adaptable. And so, you know, if you've always eaten about 20 grams of fiber and you hear me say something like that, and you're like, well, maybe I can get up to 25, 30, 35, 40. Maybe do it in a stepwise manner where you add a little bit of fiber for a week, you know, and then increase things just to avoid any of that GI discomfort. But another thing is a lot of people mistake GI discomfort as something bad, right? I don't want to glorify having GI discomfort, but just because you have GI discomfort doesn't mean that thing is not something you should do, right? People are like, oh, I get very gassy after I eat chickpeas or something. It's like, yeah, like that's totally normal. I get gassy after I eat beans. Like that's normal. Like that's not a reason to not eat those foods. In all likelihood, that's just a perfectly normal thing that happens when you eat certain types of fiber. They make it to your large intestine where you have a lot of bacteria. That bacteria ferments those fibers, and what is left or released are really good things like short chain fatty acids, but also gas. And so that's super normal. And so if you do increase your fiber and you get a little GI discomfort outside of temporarily feeling uncomfortable, that doesn't mean that this is something you should not do. It might be the case that you should slow down your increase in fiber, or it's just, hey, stick it out for another few days and you will adapt. So I've had plenty of clients who come see me and have never thought about fiber at all. And then we set a target, you know, a modest target. Maybe we start them at 20, 25 grams, but that's still much more than they were eating. And they express things like, you know, maybe bloating, maybe gas, maybe constipation. And we will either titrate back down and then work back up slowly, or we'll say, hey, you know, is it something that's a little bit of a nuisance that, you know, if it only lasted a few more days, would you want to stick that out? Are you very uncomfortable? And we'll make a decision based on that. But if you stop me on the street and say, how much fiber should you eat per day? I'd say as much as possible, as much as your GI can tolerate. So there you go. I think these days I'm at like 70, between 60 and 80 grams of fiber. But again, I eat, let's say I eat 4,000 calories. So 4,000 calories, that puts me at between 40 and 60 grams of fiber per day. So when I say I'm probably between 60 and 80 grams of fiber per day, I'm not astronomically overshooting those recommendations, just I eat a lot. Next question. I can't wrap my head around when you've said in the past that some people were able to go past failure. How? What does that mean physically? Thanks for clarifying. Yeah, I'm not really sure in what context I would have said that, and not to get overly philosophical about the word failure, but failure requires a definition. And so if we're talking about failure, or if we are defining failure as the point at which you can no longer complete another full range of motion rep, well, then you can go past that point if you go into partial reps. So if you're doing a lateral raise, let's say with dumbbells, and the full range of motion is when you get your arm up to 90 degrees, where your arm is parallel with the floor. And that would mean that going past failure would say, well, when I can't raise my arm up to 90 degrees anymore, I can raise it up to 80 degrees, and then 70 degrees, and then 60 degrees. And those are all, let's say, past failure, because we've defined failure as the point at which you can no longer do another full rep. So if you go into partial reps, that's one way to push past failure. You know, another kind of way you could say something is past failure is something like myo reps. So myo reps are when you do an initial buy-in set. So you do a regular set. Let's say it's dumbbell curls. You do a set of 8 to 12 and you go to failure. Let's say you go to failure. You put the dumbbells down, you know, or you don't, whatever. You wait somewhere between 5 and 15 seconds and then you go again for another couple really hard reps. And then you rest another 5 to 15 seconds and you do another couple really hard reps. And so that could be deemed past failure, right? Because the initial buy-in set was to failure. And then this is a almost, I would call it a set extension method. So something that extends the set beyond traditional full range of motion technical failure, as we might call it. So, you know, truthfully, true muscular failure is the point at which you can no longer move the weight at all. And if you wanted to get even more technical, true muscular failure is probably when you can't move any weight anymore. So if I do bicep curls with 30 pounds, and then I can't do any more 30-pound reps, what if I grab the 25s, and then the 20s, and then the 15s, and then the 10s, and then the 5s, and then the 2s, and then the 1s, and when I can't do a single pound, or I can't even move my arm against any resistance, that might actually be the most accurate definition of muscular failure. You know, but the truth is you could probably still do eccentric reps. And the truth is failure, when you really understand how many definitions that can have, you realize that it needs to be defined if we're going to have more advanced discussions. What's cool is we don't really need to have more advanced discussions, because 99 out of 100 times, you should think of failure when you can no longer do another good high quality rep with full range of motion. That's it. Is there nuance? Is there room to kind of break that or go beyond that, like we talked about? Yeah, absolutely. But I think you can get pretty dang far with just thinking about it like that. Next question. If I'm doing your 3-time-per-week program and running 3 times per week, that's awesome, by the way, weekly mileage of 13 to 18 miles, is that too much to grow in both areas? Assuming diet and sleep are locked in, that is. I like them both, but like lifting more, but want to keep my cardiovascular gains as well. Yep, I think that is not too much, and you can absolutely grow in both areas. I'm going to say this I'm going to say it, but I'm also going to be self-deprecating at the same time. Like, that's not that much training. And I'm not being a dick. That is a lot of training when we're talking about just general health. That is a lot of training, 3 times a week lifting, 3 times a week running. That's an incredible routine. You are killing it, and I'm super duper proud. And I think more people should get close to between 2 and 3 lifts and between 2 and 3 cardio sessions if their goal is health. But I say that's not so much training, because there are people doing way more than that. I think of a guy that, you know, you should be following, Alec Blennis. Alec is like lifting 6 times a week and doing cardio 6 times a week. Now, Alec is a unique kind of unicorn. He's a freak of nature, but you're going to be fine. If you're eating enough and sleeping enough, you're going to improve at both of them. Now, will you, I know you're not asking this, but I want to be kind of a more holistic answer here. Will you get as good at both of them as if you were doing either alone? Of course not. You know, it's like, hey, I'm studying French and Spanish at the same time every other day. Will I get better at both? Yes. If I just studied French, would I get better at French quicker? Yes. I know that, where you're like, hey, I know that there's some sort of sacrifice. Now, that is not because of some physiological interference effect, right? That's not because some sort of hormonal cascade when you lift that interferes with the type of adaptations you need to make when you do cardio. It's not about that. It's about just total amount of work that you could be doing, right? You're training 6 days a week right now. You could be training 6 days a week with just lifting. You could be running just 6 days a week. So it's not so much about some sort of physiological interference. It's about you have a finite amount of work that you can do. And if you spread that work across more than one thing, then by definition, you could be, you know, you are dividing up the results that you'll get between two things. But do I think you could get better at both? Absolutely. Do I think the ceiling at how good you can get at either of them is lower because you're doing both of them? Of course. I'm basically doing the same thing you are. I'm running maybe 20 miles a week. I'm in marathon prep, but 15 to 20 miles for the last couple of years. And I've gotten a lot better. Do I think I will get infinitely better, right? Do I think that this will be enough running for me to get better, or enough lifting for me to get better forever? I don't know. I still think I'm improving at both, but I would, being realistic, I think I'm not going to just get better forever on 3 days a week. I think with lifting, you know, it's a little bit different. I think that's probably sufficient for quite a bit longer. Like, you can get really freaking jacked on 3 days a week with proper nutrition, diet, sleep, and patience. But running tends to be a little bit more volume dominant. And so, you know, yeah, just think that the ceiling for how good you can get at running with 3 days a week is a little lower than the ceiling for how jacked you can get on 3 days a week lifting. But I think you're doing awesome. Sounds amazing. I wish more people would take this sort of an approach. That's awesome. Next question. I know TDEE calculators are all just an educated guess, but how do you determine activity level? If someone does your program 4 times per week, cardio 1 hour a week, and gets 12,000 steps a day. Where does that land? Now, I'm at my computer right now, so bear with me. Developed is just a gross overstatement. I will be releasing a calorie calculator on my page that everybody can use. And I've wrestled with this problem of activity level. I'll start by saying, you know, what you already said, which is it's just a guess. You're overthinking it. It's not going to be perfect. Just friggin' start. Everything you already know, which is like, it doesn't matter. It won't be perfect. You need to start tracking data and let the data guide your increases and decreases in calories. But I will respect your question because with every calorie calculator, you ultimately have to pick, right? You have to make a decision. So while I think that decision isn't that important and you should just use your best estimate, get started, right? Let me just make that part clear. With a good calorie calculator, you'll put in your weight, your age, your sex, your height, all that stuff. And then that's going to help you calculate your BMR, which is basically your resting energy expenditure, which is the amount of calories that your body needs just to run your machine, that is your body. If you laid down on a couch all day just to keep the lights on. But then we have to calculate how many calories you burn through movement. So we have to have some sort of what's called an activity multiplier. So we take those characteristics, age, sex, height, weight, in an algorithm, and then there's a multiplier by how much that machine moves that gives us all of the energy that you expend. You know, it's called your total daily energy expenditure. So at every point in a calorie calculator, you should be entering some sort of activity level. On my calorie calculator has four options. It says sedentary, light activity, moderate activity, and high activity. And the truth is, it's really challenging to do what you said, which is perfectly put you in a bucket, right? You're saying, hey, I'm lifting 4 days a week. I personally wouldn't even consider lifting in this when it says activity level. You just don't burn that many calories when it comes to lifting. And I think it's just easier to conceptualize that as not a high calorie burn per minute, such that it definitely factors in, but I would think about the movement you're doing outside of lifting when I answer that question. So you're doing cardio an hour per week. That's definitely not nothing. And 12,000 steps a day is a lot. So to me, I think mine has four categories: sedentary, light activity, moderate activity, and high activity. I tried to equate them in terms of steps, but even that's not perfect. So for me, sedentary is 3,000 to 6,000 steps per day. Light activity is 6 to 9 steps. Moderate activity is 10,000 ish. And high activity is greater than 10,000 steps per day, or somebody doing intentional cardio a few times a week. And so I'd probably put you in that high activity category. But I think if you ask me to give you the answer that I'm the most certain about, I'd say you are at least in the moderate activity category. So if you wanted to be conservative with your calories, you might pick that moderate activity one. If you weren't conservative and you were like, hey, I don't mind if I overshoot because I'm fine course correcting, then maybe go with the higher one. Or if you're uncertain between two, maybe just go with the middle. Calculate both, right? In this calorie calculator, you can calculate one, get your number, calculate the other, and then maybe take, you know, just the middle of those two numbers and get started. So I don't think this is holding anybody back from seeing results, because you should never be taking these numbers at face value. You take them as an educated guess and you get started. But I respect the fact that you have to make this choice at some point in the process. And so that's how I would go about doing it. Next question. Hello, no matter what I do, I can't get rid of extra fat/cellulite on legs. I swear it looks like I have an extra knee. Is this genetics, need more muscle, or body fat? I'm 26% currently. As always, thank you for awesome programming. Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm glad you're enjoying it. Cellulite is an interesting topic. While I'd say there's a sliver of nuance, the truth is you really can't do much when it comes to cellulite. You can reasonably improve the aesthetic with less fat and more muscle, but you can't target the cellulite directly. I know you said, you know, you didn't say that, but that would be where I'd start. Hey, like the cellulite itself, we can't do anything about. But building muscle and losing fat in the area will most likely lead people to, hey, that's an outcome that I'm happier with. You also can't just target fat loss. And so if you're like, hey, I'm carrying more fat in my legs, then the answer is to lose weight everywhere, right? I mean, I say everywhere because you can't choose. The answer is just lose weight. Some people carry weight. Well, actually, everybody carries weight somewhat disproportionately on different parts of their body. You know, people might, some people, you know, lose weight in their stomach earlier than others. Some people lose weight in their butt early on. Some people lose weight in their legs. Some people, hey, you know, it really on my lower back, I hold on to weight there. That's the last thing to go. And everybody's going to have a slightly different story when it comes to, hey, this is how I lose fat for sure. But the answer is, yeah, if you're like, hey, I have this area of my body that has more fat than I'd like it to have. What do I do? You lose weight everywhere. Now, that's not a suggestion, by the way, because if you are, in fact, a female at 26% body fat, like, that's super healthy. I think the fact that you know your body fat percentage always makes me feel a slight level of discomfort, because I don't think that we have really good ways to measure that accurately. But, you know, whatever. If that's a ballpark, then I think you're in already a really healthy place, 26%. You know, just to be clear, when we look epidemiologically at where women are the healthiest, it's like, I think the healthiest range is roughly 30% body fat. So that doesn't mean you're less healthy at lower than that. But all I'm saying is, I don't know other statistics about you. I just know that it sounds like you're already in a healthy place, but you have some fat that you seem to not be able to get rid of. And the answer is, you can't target it. You can't target the cellulite, but you can focus on building muscle there, and you can focus on losing fat overall. That's not a suggestion. It is my bias that for people who have an area like this, I don't get to decide. I just want you to know the words that come out of my mouth next are not directed at how you should feel, that you get to decide what's important to you. But I have just seen over many, 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 many years that that area, to really lose to lose weight in the area that you lose it last, right? By definition means getting really lean, right? If you don't lose weight, if you hold weight in your lower back for a long time, then by definition, in order to lose that lower back fat, you'd have to get really lean. And that, by transitive property with a different bias of mine, getting really lean isn't really worth it for most people in most cases. So, you know, as much as I think people can do whatever they want, and I think people should feel empowered to go after whatever they want, I'd think strongly about what it would take to lose fat in those kind of quote-unquote trouble areas, and just maybe go for it and see if it's worth it. But I wouldn't be surprised if you're like, damn, I need to get really lean before that area starts to change, and I don't want to do those things forever. I would resonate with that point of view. Next question. Wanting to add in some plyometric sessions. When, where would you recommend these being implemented? After or before a lift? Separate day from a lower body. Thanks, coach. I'll start by saying, anytime you're thinking about when to add something in, I need to say, doing it at all is 99% of it. So if you're like perseverating over the perfect place to put this in your program, by the way, this question, by the way, I have thought about a lot. And it's a hard question to answer, kind of. I'll explain where I'm at with this question. But the answer is, if you want to add in plyometrics, there's probably better and worse places to add it, but there's also more and less convenient places to add it. And doing it at all is just the by far most important thing. So for plyometrics, it's probably best to do them early on in a session, right? Plyometrics are mostly neuromuscular adaptations, and those are probably best achieved in a state of low fatigue. So if you have a really heavy leg day and then you want to do plyometrics, like, you're going to be way worse at them, and you'll probably just be, you'll get less adaptations. But if you said, hey, Jordan, the only time I'm going to do plyometrics is after my leg day, is it still worth doing? Absolutely yes. 100% yes. But there are better and worse times. So you want plyometrics to come in a time when you're reasonably unfatigued. So early on in a session or on their own day. And that's been a struggle for me because I don't care. I'll just share my experience, by the way. This is just my experience. I don't care enough about plyometrics right now to put them before a session that I do care about. Right, so if I put them before a lift and I do 15 minutes of plyometrics, or even less, even 10 minutes of plyometrics, like, I might not want to do that because after those 10 minutes, maybe I'm a little tired and maybe I'm a little baby. I'm not somebody who, I see other people on this app and they love training and they love working super hard and they grind and they train hard. That's not me. That's not me. I like training, but I mostly like what it does for me. I'm not as much of a, kill myself and go to a dark place and spend hours and hours and hours on training. I want to train 45 minutes a day and I want to be in the upper echelon of health, but I'm not somebody who's like, you know, just so focused on optimizing everything. So for me, sometimes I will do plyometrics and then I'll think, I don't want to spend that fatigue. I don't want to spend those 15 minutes before a lift, which I care about more, or before a run, which I care about more. But plyometrics are an interesting beast. I think jumping exercises are, like, if you think of a pie chart, right? And that pie chart is just for exercise. And it's all the types of exercise that you can do. So there's endurance running, there's lifting weights, there's lifting really heavy weights, there's lifting lighter weights. And every single sliver contributes to your overall function, your physical function. There's Pilates, there's yoga, there's mobility, there's zone two cardio, there's sprinting, there's jumping, there's lifting, there's hypertrophy, there's strength, Olympic lifting, everything. Do I think there is a part of that pie chart that is uniquely covered by plyometrics? Absolutely, of course. There's a part of that pie chart that is uniquely covered by every single type of exercise. So if you were trying to fill that pie chart, well, you'd have to be doing everything. And I just don't see that as practical. Like, people think I don't think mobility training is worth anything. That's not true. I think there is a part of that pie chart that is only covered by mobility training. I tend to think that lifting weights covers enough of that mobility section that you should do that first, because it also has other benefits. But I think that there is a unique independent part of that pie chart covered by mobility, and similarly here for plyometrics. So I do think that there is a relevant rationale for doing it. But again, I do think, you know, you can get some of those benefits from lifting and fast running. So lifting and fast running might also give you other cardiometabolic and just metabolic benefits that I think are worth checking that box first. So I know that that was a long-winded question, and I didn't even answer your question too much. I guess I did, but the best place to do them would be by themselves. 15 minutes, 15, 20 minutes by themselves. The next best place might be before any session. The least good place would be after a really hard leg day. But all of those times are better than not doing it at all. And it's not that they're just like, oh, it's a little bit better than not. No, it's infinitely better than not doing it at all. So if the way you're going to do this is by putting it at the end, you know, one of the practical thoughts I've had is put it after your upper body day. You might be a little neurologically fatigued, and that will have an impact on your plyometric performance and adaptations. But your local muscles in your lower body won't be so tired. And so that might be a real reasonable way for you to put it in a place where it's not pre-fatiguing you for something you might care about more, but it's still super productive. So hopefully that helps. Next question, feeling back exercises in my biceps, not my back. Any form tips? Yeah, I think I would video your technique for exercises, and I would look at your elbow angle as your arm gets closer to your body. If that elbow angle is more acute, like a smaller angle, that probably means you're using your forearm and your bicep a bit too much. Some of the cues that can help for like a row, for example, is to pull your elbow down towards your hip instead of just thinking about driving the elbow back. The second thing is use straps, use Versa grips, use lifting straps, take some of that gripping component out of the exercise, and you'll be able to do the whole, you know, think of your hands as hooks sort of cue. That's not something I've said a whole lot in my life, but yeah, once you strap up to an exercise, you might find, oh, I don't have to grip as hard, and then I'm not getting that crazy sensation in my bicep and my forearms as much. I would rather you think about your back exercises as moving at the elbow than thinking about pulling with your hands. So think about moving with your elbow, less with your hands, and the way that you can help that and improve that is to use Versa grips or lifting straps. Next question, how are you liking the new home? What are the things you love about your new neighborhood? So the two gems of this house are the basement, which is my gym office, which is our sort of sanctuary where we will have just the rest of our lives, hopefully, lifting and exercising with our kids as a family. I'll be down here working and filming, and just, it's a gem down here. I'm really just very happy with it. And the second gem is the backyard. It's just a very peaceful backyard. That's all I'll say. It's not about aesthetics. It's not about this or that. We have trees in the backyard that make us feel a little bit secluded, and it's peaceful. It's quiet. We don't have loud neighbors. You know, we can sit outside and hear the birds chirping and let the dogs run around. You know, we can put up a soccer net somewhere if we want to for the kids or for us, whatever. So we're super stoked. We like the house. It's not, we don't live in some mansion, but it is just awesome for our needs. And we're very blessed. It's a beautiful house. We're very happy. Get beautiful light in the morning. That's something that's very healthy, like mentally for me. Our kitchen and our dining area get a ton of natural light in the morning. So when we sit down and have breakfast with Emerson and, you know, potential future babies, et cetera, that's just a really nice thing. So yeah, we're very excited about that. Some things we love about the new neighborhood. I know it's going to sound insane, but we bought this house without ever seeing it in person. You know, we had been to the area a couple of times, but I cannot say that we know the area in and out. I've been exploring the area on my runs, and we've been trying to, try new restaurants. And listen, the neighborhood is great. There's a lot of kids, which is awesome. Families, you know, kids on the corner waiting for the bus for school. Just feels like a nice, safe area, a nice, quiet neighborhood, not a ton of through traffic, that sort of stuff. So that's something we wanted. We wanted a place where there would be trick-or-treaters. I know that that's not independently what's important, but that represents to me a place that is family oriented and quiet enough where kids walk around on Thanksgiving, that sort of place. So we're happy about that. I'll keep you posted though, as we learn a bit more. Next question. Should you track the calories in stuff like stevia? No. I don't even think stevia has calories, right? Does stevia, up until you asked that question, I would have definitively told you that stevia does not have calories. No, stevia doesn't have calories. When you say stuff like stevia, my guess is you think you're talking about like artificial sweeteners, like stevia, maybe monk fruit, allulose, sugar alcohols, aspartame, that sort of stuff. They don't have any calories, so I would not track them. Next question. Seeing conflicting messages about fasted cardio being bad for women's hormones and energy availability. Do I have any thoughts? Yes. I would go follow Dr. Lauren C.S. She was also on a podcast recently with, I'm guessing, the person who you heard this from, which is Dr. Stacey Sims. And they did a bit on this topic that I think everyone should listen to. I do think that whenever people go on to debate, it never really lives up to it. I don't think, it's frustrating. I think Dr. Lauren is an amazing resource for this sort of stuff. And I think Stacey Sims did not, let's not get me going down that route. There is no, I'm going to be very clear here, there is no research to back up the claim that fasted cardio is bad for women's hormones and energy availability when calories are equated across the day. There is no research to say that fasted cardio is bad for women's hormones and energy availability when calories are equated across the day. So if you eat the same amount of calories, but you train fasted, or the same amount of calories, or you train fed, no difference. Your decision to train fasted or not should be down to personal preference. It should be down to convenience. It should be down to how you feel when you train. Do you feel better when you're fasted? Do you feel better when you're fed? What is most convenient for you? What makes you most likely to be consistent with exercise? The consideration for women's hormones and the consideration for energy availability, I respect, but there just is no data to support some sort of disruption in this regard when total calories are equated. Next question, last question here. Is it normal for average heart rate on easy runs to increase at peak week in training cycle, training for a half marathon right now, at the same speed? I was at 134 average BPM and now around 145 for what feels like the same effort. So yes, is the short answer. That is possible because you're likely under a greater amount of fatigue now. But heart rate is tricky, man. Like if you had flipped this and you said, hey, my heart rate's actually lower now and I'm really struggling to get up to speed, that also would make sense if you're under a lot of fatigue. So heart rate is not necessarily heart rate is useful, but I wouldn't read into this as like, oh my God, something bad is happening. There are so many things that can impact your heart rate on a run. You need a lot of data to look at this and be like, oh, I'm really carrying a whole bunch of fatigue and my heart rate's way higher than it should be, or any of those claims. I run every day with it, or every run I do, I wear a chest strap. I look at my heart rate, but what matters most is your perception. So you said it feels like the same effort. To me, that far outweighs what your heart rate was. If you went out for an easy run and it felt easy, or it felt whatever. It doesn't need to feel easy. It feels like X. And to perform at pace X, a couple weeks ago, it was 134 BPM. Today, 145 BPM. But both times at pace X, it felt Y. It felt kind of easier. It felt really easy, whatever. At the same pace for the same RPE, we'll say, I'm not so worried about your heart rate. I'll tell you now, the athletes, the runners that I coach, I'm way more interested in your perception of how the run went than I am the underlying heart rate data. The heart rate data I look at as a way of kind of as a BS check. You know, if a client tells me that the workout was super easy, but their heart rate is climbing every interval, climbing, then I might poke around to see if that's really what they were feeling, not as a lie detector, but just as an extra piece of context. But if I have an athlete that says, hey, Jordan, I finished this run, it felt a 7 out of 10 RPE, and you know, I could have easily done another hour at that pace. That's way more important to me than, well, their heart rate was a little bit higher. Because when it comes to like what an easy, like zone 2 or zone 1 heart rate is, it varies differently from person to person. It's going to vary day to day. It might be difference in weather. It might be difference in humidity. It might be difference in hydration, in nutrition, in sleep. There's so many factors. So when you said it feels like the same effort, that's by far the most important piece of data for me. All right. Thanks for listening, guys. I appreciate all the questions coming in. I'll answer, I guess, the rest of these on Instagram or on the next episode. And I'll see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram, @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.